across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan Show!
Hello there, we really appreciate you downloading this podcast from the BBC. And don't forget, we're here fighting for you every day of the week. If you want to contact us, nolan@bbc.co.uk. I hope you enjoy today's podcast. The Stephen Nolan Show! Good morning. Thanks for joining us today. So the DUP guns are aimed at the Health Minister this morning, and it's Diane Dodds firing the shots. She wants to know what's happening with the Maternity and Children's Hospital project and says the unprecedented delays are unacceptable. Hundreds of thousands on waiting lists, she says, equally unacceptable. The DUP MLA is with us this morning. Diane, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. So this hospital, there's well over 100 million spent so far, but it's a complicated, complex project that's been riddled with problems, hardly by Nesbitt's fault, because those problems started well before he came in.
Well, Stephen, first of all, I'd have to say I haven't trained any sort of criticism towards Mike Nesbitt on this in particular. We are all looking forward to a new children's hospital and a new maternity unit where the facilities and services for new mothers, their babies, many of them premature, will be of the highest standard. And I think we can all agree that this is a really good thing to be doing, and we should be working towards getting it sorted out. I suppose the problem with all of this is that we're now in a situation where the new maternity element of this very large project has doubled in cost. So we know that it is now costing $97 million, and we're still counting. And the problem with the maternity element of this is that when this building was handed over between the trust and the contractor, a few weeks later, they discover a very dangerous pathogen, Pseudomonas, in the water system, and therefore the hospital was deemed unsafe for use. And we now are in a situation where the hospital is built, it is handed over to the trust, but it is unsafe for use because of the problems within the water system. Now, we need to establish very, very clearly where and how much this is going to cost to fix, how and who will take responsibility for fixing that. And obviously, those are negotiations between the trust and the contractor. That's has been made very clear by the many questions and answers that I've had between myself and the health department. But on top of that, we have also the project for the children's hospital, a much, much needed hospital. And I speak as a parent who spent many years in the children's hospital. And we need to also make sure that the problems that have occurred at the maternity hospital will not occur when we start building the children's hospital, which is not projected now to finish until 2030 and almost 10 years overdue.
Well, you say, Diane, that you're not targeting Mike Nesbitt, you're not criticising him. The actual motion that's been laid down, that this Assembly deplores the lack of progress and action towards, that it's unacceptable. You say, given that the Department of Health accounts for over half of all day-to-day spending for the public purse, that people across Northern Ireland have experienced little benefit, hundreds of thousands languishing on waiting lists are struggling to access timely health and social care, points out the recent draft framework for the reconfiguration of hospital lacks detail. How's that not Mike, criticising Mike Nesbitt? Who else is responsible if he's not?
I think since Mike came in, actually, he has actually published a draft framework. I'm on record and will continue to say that that draft framework is underwhelming. It pretty much describes the situation as is. And It is now within a 16-week consultation period. And if we continue to do that with every element of reform and continue not to publish really visionary documents, then we will still we'll end this mandate at the Assembly without having done an awful lot in terms of reform of the health service. And reform of the health service is key. It is absolutely key to getting down waiting lists and having a more efficient and productive health service that actually fits the needs of our population. A few weeks ago in the Assembly, Stephen, I did a debate on breast cancer referral times. So the departmental target for a woman who discovers a lump in her breast until she is seen by a specialist is 14 days. No trust in Northern Ireland meets that target. And in fact, some of the trusts fail that target by huge margins. And some only meet it by, for example, the Southern Trust, my area here in Upper Ban, only 1 in 10 women will actually be seen within that target time. These are not really things that we can ignore. And we need to get on ahead with making sure that our health service is responding to needs.
Maybe, Dan, that's why we shouldn't have had 5 of the last 8 years without a government. Because the executive was collapsed.
Maybe that's
why you and your party should, I don't know, do you think your party should apologise or were wrong on reflection to collapse the executive in 2022?
Well, the collapse of the executive in 2022 was for very specific reasons. And we are now in a situation where we have devolution fully functioning. We have a health department, and in fact we had a health department functioning throughout this period of time. And we now need to take some decisions. You know, I do believe that, and I sit on the health committee, I work on health issues probably 4 out of 5 days every single week of my working life. And I do believe that there is a real appetite to get things right for people in Northern Ireland. And I do think that the health minister would have a significant degree of support were to step out along that journey.
And well, he's asked for more money, hasn't he?
And yes, but we cannot be in a situation where health now equates to well over 50% of the budget. I think the finance minister described it as 57% of this year's total budget, because we do need money for education, for police, for communities, for the voluntary and community service. We need funding for a whole range of other things.
But
so we've got to work as well with what we have. We have in Northern Ireland the most expensive health service per head of population in the whole of the United Kingdom, but we have some of the worst outcomes and the longest waiting lists.
But it's important
to get on top of that.
But let's go into some of the detail around it. But what does your motion, Diane, do for the morale of all of those hardworking health staff when your motion says that although the Department of Health accounts for over half of all day-to-day spending from the public purse, people across Northern Ireland have experienced little practical benefit? Doesn't the health service benefit hundreds, if not thousands, of people every single day? Is the DUP really saying little practical benefit from the health service and the workers?
Well, I am on record many, many times, Stephen, is saying that our health service workers are the greatest and biggest asset that we have. They have been the glue that has held together.
But you're telling them this morning that the day-to-day spending has little practical benefit.
You need to hear me out on this. They are the glue that has held an almost broken system together. What we now need to be doing is helping them to mend that system, because many of them are frustrated beyond belief. I recently was with the RCN, the Royal College of Nurses, and they express a situation where They are managing in very, very difficult circumstances. They are managing complex medical needs in very difficult circumstances. And they do an amazing job for us here in Northern Ireland. And we should never forget that. And the same with the health support staff. I had reason to be in the Ulster Hospital in Dundonald a few Sunday nights ago visiting. And I was talking to some of the health support staff that were there, and they were doing an amazing job in a difficult situation. So I'm not lying. This isn't about individuals. This is about trying to get to a system where we can meet people's needs as they come through the door. That will always be difficult. It will always be difficult. But it's really important that we get to that system. And it's really important, Stephen, coming back to the part of the motion that deals with the capital projects, it's really important that we get the health estate that actually meets the century that we're in. Some of the buildings that our hospitals are in are out of date. It's difficult to control infection, but we also must make sure that when we are doing that, that we're giving value for money and that we get to a situation where we can build these new projects and build them in confidence, knowing that they won't overrun in terms of time or in terms of money.
And just before you go, I know you need to go now, Diane. The assisted dying bill, of course, will be heard on Friday. There's a lot of talk. I was on Five Live the weekend talking about this. Help me understand where you're coming from with something that is so emotional and many people feel should be a personal choice. The right to choose how you die, when you die, for yourself.
Well, it is a huge subject, Stephen, and a very difficult subject. And one, I suppose, if we're all honest, we probably tend to shy away from and don't want to really talk about it. But it is important that the state has a principle that values life. And that is absolutely where I'm coming from this. I do not think that the state should be offering assisted dying. I think that the state should be offering support for those who are in the most difficult circumstances of their life to actually live well in the circumstances they find themselves. We have a situation where, and I've spoken to Marie Curie, I've spoken to the hospices, and they do amazing work, but they are constantly looking for more and more funding. We need to fund our palliative care services better. And the Health Committee are currently doing an investigation into palliative care in Northern Ireland. And I would encourage people to respond to the consultation document that has been put out in relation to that, because we need to offer care and support for those who are in the most vulnerable part of their life. Can I say also, this is a private member's bill. This bill would represent one of the greatest and biggest shifts in policy that any government could make. It is not for a private member's bill process. And that is completely wrong. There's no impact assessment with the bill. The government says, well, actually, if it passes on Friday, we'll do the impact assessment then. That is completely back to front. People should know the impact of this on society. Vulnerable groups should be able to express their opinion. Instead, we're getting 5 hours of debate in the House of Commons on Friday morning. I think that is just wrong.
Diane Dodds, I know you need to go, so thank you very much indeed for this morning. Thank you, Diane. 030 30 80 55 55. So a lot in there. Dr. John Kyle listening to this, former councillor, UUP party member. Morning, John.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Look, we'll talk about the hospital. We'll talk about the maternity unit in a second. But just to pick up on what Diane Dodds has said about this private members bill on Friday. She says life is sacrosanct and that we should be pumping more resource in to help people have a comfortable death rather than them being allowed to take their own life.
Yes, yes, and that is a very strong argument, Stephen. The problem about about me making a decision about my life and my death is that it does have implications for other people. And the danger of this assisted dying bill, or assisted suicide bill, as it should really be called, is that it places vulnerable people at risk of being under pressure to acquiesce to their lives being ended.
And what about the vulnerable people who are of sound mind and are in excruciating pain and want it to end? What about them?
The answer to that is good palliative care, Stephen. And actually, when people...
Well, that's your answer to that, John, but why are you intervening in other people's lives?
I'm not intervening in other people's lives. I'm providing care for them when they need it at the time
they
want
it. Some of them don't want it.
Yes, but if we acquiesce to legalizing assisted suicide, it has massive ramifications, and the people who are most at risk are the most vulnerable. The people who are disabled, the elderly, the people who are dependent upon others, and we place them in a totally unacceptable position where they will feel under pressure to acquiesce.
So, John, let's actually look at the safeguards that are proposed to be in place if this was ever to become law. Someone's got to be terminally ill with a likelihood of 6 months or less to live. Two different doctors have got to determine that that person is of sound mind and making a free choice. It then goes to a High Court judge. A High Court judge scrutinises that individual and their capacity to make the decision and whether they're making it of free will. There's then a time delay where that person has more time to consider whether they want to take their own life. It then goes back to a High Court judge again for a second time for them to check that everything is in order. A doctor cannot hand over the substance that would end life. The individual's got to take it themselves. Does that sound like someone's being left in a vulnerable position to you?
Stephen, how do you know that the person is not under pressure? How do you know that the person does not feel coerced into accepting this?
Well, that's why those checks and balances are in place, and you're right, some people might be under pressure, but what is for the greater good here, John? Look, there's no right answer, is there? For those people who feel that the state is intervening in their lives, and they're lying there, and they can't move, sometimes they can't swallow, sometimes they're in excruciating pain, and this could be you, or this could be me in the future.
Stephen, good palliative care addresses all of those issues. And Oregon is often quoted as the best example of effective and successful assisted dying. And in Oregon, the latest research shows that 47% of those who come forward for assisted dying have felt pressure to do so. They've felt under pressure to acquiesce to this process of assisted dying. You cannot protect people from coercion, from feeling under pressure, from feeling some sort of emotional pressure to engage in it. And the answer, Stephen, the answer is to provide good palliative care. And people can have some choice in that. They can choose where they die. They can choose who's present with them when they die. They can make arrangements for what happens up to their death and after their death for their funeral. You can have valuable and important and crucial conversations as you prepare for death. So what we have is an inadequate palliative care service, and that is where the focus should be. We should be providing better palliative care for all who need it. And that safeguards the vulnerable from feeling under pressure to acquiesce to assisted dying.
The number this morning, 030-30-80-55-55. Do you think you should be able to choose for yourself, or in having that freedom to do so, are you putting vulnerable people who might not have a safe family around them, who might be pressurized by family or indeed the government of the day? If you're living that's costing the NHS money, what if you get some type of administration at some time in the future where it would be handy not to have so many people living in a stretched NHS? 030-30-80-55-55. Now to what you're on to talk about, John. And that is Diane Dodds calling out the health minister, wanting an independent inquiry into the handling of the maternity and children's hospital project, which still is not completed all of these years later.
Yes, Stephen. And it is very concerning that it is uncompleted, and these delays are unacceptable. But as you pointed out, to lay the blame at the door of Mike Nesbitt, I think is unreasonable, it's perverse, and to be honest, it's somewhat hypocritical. This is the original completion date for the maternity hospital was 2015. That was at a time when the DUP held the post of Minister of Health. So these delays are over a decade long. And as you pointed out, over the past 8 years, for five of those years, we've had no functioning executive. And then also, we've been dealing with the impact of COVID and the chaos that it caused. So it is very regrettable, it's unacceptable, but it's where we are. And I think to blame Mike Nesbitt 9 months into the current post, I think is a bit rich, to be honest.
Okay, well, you say that. But Mike Nesbitt, we are where we are now. The buck stops with him now.
Yes.
Is there any actual target date for when this should be completed and all doors open? We're already 10 years behind schedule. 10 years, John.
Yep, absolutely, Stephen. It's terrible. But in terms of the maternity hospital, there is Pseudomonas in the water supply, and that has to be dealt with.
So it cannot be until
that's dealt with. So independent experts are working on it to deal with that. So that
And they
will
have
be
been working on it to deal with it. But yes. Is the public not entitled for a target date for a minister to stand up and say, okay, the buck stops with me. Here's where we aim to have this open for. Like, what? Yes. It cannot be open-ended, can it?
No, it can't. It can't, but it cannot open when the Pseudomonas is there. So we have to rely on the experts to clean up the water supply and to ensure that the water supply is safe.
So how are they doing at the moment? I wonder how the experts are doing at the moment. I wonder when they think there is a completion date.
Yes, well, maybe we need to speak to them. But Pseudomonas is a particularly difficult problem. But to the broader issue, Stephen, I mean, reforming the health service is a huge undertaking. Every jurisdiction is struggling to cope with the pressures on the health service. It is a 10 to 15 year project. And actually, Mike Nesbitt has made an excellent start. I mean, it's not that he's sitting there twiddling his thumbs. He has done a huge amount. There's been the rollout of the multidisciplinary teams in the general practice. He has published and reviewed the elective care framework for elective care centres to deal with the waiting list. He has published a hospital framework document to see how we can best use our hospital estate. He's settled the pay awards for health and social care staff. He's dealt with changes to contracts for the consultants. He's put together a £70 million social care support package. He's setting out the community pharmacy plan. He's rebooted the Bengoa report. So, I mean, he has done a huge amount in 9 months, and Robin Swan before him, despite the disruption and chaos that COVID caused. I think it's quite unreasonable and somewhat hypocritical to be criticising Mike Nesbitt, but we do have huge challenges.
But what's the Belfast Trust leadership team doing? John, what is the Belfast leadership team the Belfast Trust leadership team actually doing? They're having some type of independent review, and they cannot give a date as to when this is going to open. Is that good enough?
Well, those are two separate things. The independent review has to look at the causes, the problems, the delays, and there's a huge list of them, Stephen. You know, there's the issue of contaminated land, the issue of unexpected ground conditions, prolonged approval periods, the fallout from the Grenfell fire and the implications for fire and safety, the impact of COVID, hypervision. There's been a whole list of problems, and I'm not pretending that's not that's irrelevant. You know, it does need to be dealt with. The independent review will deal with it. Lessons will be learned. That is really important. Actually getting an opening date, we are stuck on the issue of the Pseudomonas, and we're reliant upon the experts, bacteriologists, those contractors who can deal with this problem, to deal with it. And until they do, it would be a gross active irresponsibility to open the maternity hospital until that is dealt with. So therefore, it is an issue, Stephen. There are huge challenges around.
Yeah, and Pseudomonas, so that people know, Pseudomonas does not usually affect healthy people, but infants and people with weakened immune systems are vulnerable. But look, is there communication and ample communication between the Belfast Trust and the Department of Health? Is anybody actually taking control of this? Might we be here in 4 or 5 years' time with this facility still closed down? Has this happened elsewhere? Is everything being done that can be done? The repairs to the building expected to run to several million pounds. Is this all good enough?
Stephen, my understanding is that everything that can be done is being done. Certainly to wait another 4 or 5 years would be utterly unacceptable. But my understanding is that this issue is being actively addressed. And as soon as we're assured that newborn infants will be safe in the maternity unit, it will be up and in functioning order.
But what Mike Nesbitt has said, John, is it's a very serious problem which may take a very long time to fix. Like, what does that mean?
Well, how long is a bit of string, Stephen? Our hands are tied. You know, these are difficult issues. The problem of antibiotic-resistant bacteria is a huge problem for the health service, whether you're in Africa, Asia, or North America, or in Northern Ireland. So dealing with these bacteria is a problem. But My understanding is that everything that can be done is being done, and we just have to wait until we're given the all clear.
Okay. John, thanks for being on this morning. 03030 80 55 55. Lots of you contacting us this morning. That's what we like to do, hear from you, and we'll do that straight after the news. So the Maternity and Children's Hospital, Diane Dodds, raising that today. And asking for urgent action around it. We also obviously have the debate around assisted dying. Cherie's called us about that. Morning, Cherie.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Thanks for calling us. Go ahead, Cherie. Tell us what you think.
Yes, Stephen. So I wanted to phone in and give my opinion on this here. So currently, my mother, she's 75, and she is living with this awful dementia. And I do believe that people should have the option, because my mother would say it's like living in torture at the moment. And many times, many times, she has said about taking her own life, because, as I used the word torture, my mother's in moderate stages dementia, so we have a bit to go with this disease. And we've went from a very strong woman that had 5 children to a lady that can't even put together the steps to make a cup of tea. So it's torture for her, it's torture for us, and as I said, she has often talked about and used the word suicide.
And what have you said to her when she has Cherie? Would you want her to be able to take her own life?
At this stage, if my mother... yes, I would. Yes, I would. As much as I would miss my mother, but as anybody knows and has experienced somebody that has dementia, you lose the person daily. You lose part of them daily. And for her, it's torture. And for us, her children watching her, having to bath her, having to do everything, or we she can't swallow properly. Yes, I mean, as I say, it's torture. And we're only at moderate stages at the moment. If my mother wanted to take that decision, then yes, absolutely.
And look, what I'm about to ask you here, it's no slight on you, right? It's at the heart of the debate. It's at the heart of this discussion for all of us.
Yes.
But you've just said there, it's torturous for you.
Yes.
And right at the very heart of this being talked about throughout the UK is how do you protect people from being pressured into wanting to do this? Now, in you saying out loud that this is torturous for you, might that influence your mother? Would it have the potential to do that if people like you talk like that? How safe are vulnerable people?
Yeah. Well, for a start, I would never, ever say to my mother, you know, it's torture enough. Never. She would be very, very well protected from how we're coping with this and how we're feeling about this here, losing her to the dementia. So she would never be influenced by us. And when she talks about or uses the word suicide or ending her life, I mean, obviously we are calming her down. We are telling her that she has all the support around her, and that we're here and we will see her through this here. So she would be very much protected and never influenced. But, I mean,
and I hear that. I hear that loud and clear. I hear that loud and clear. But part of why you said yes this morning, in terms of you would want your mum to do it, is because you're losing the mum you knew.
Absolutely. Absolutely. My feelings do come into play and my thoughts around this here. But it would never, as I stated, would never influence my mother, because she's no idea how we feel and how we're struggling with this here. We're a very, very strong family and we've got a lot of resilience. And she would never know.
At what point do you think any of us, if this did become law, can decide what's the right time to stop our lives?
I think if the person is suffering, and I do, you know, in terms, I can only speak for on my own personal opinion on this here. I think while the person is coherent enough to make that decision, and they are struggling, I think that they should be in a position to be allowed or unable to make that decision for themselves.
It's. Do you think you would do it? Do you think you could do it? Do you think you could lift up whatever the substance is? Because that's what you've got to do. Doctors wouldn't be allowed to do it. That's the proposal.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you're coherent, as I said, you would have the capacity to do that. And you would be able to do that. And if it was your wish and you knew what you were doing, I dare say that you would be able to do it if it was your wish to end your life.
Do you fear death?
No. No, I'm a Christian, Stephen, so I don't fear death.
And
I don't fear death at all.
What does God say about bringing death forward like this? What's
okay,
the Christian
faith
say?
The Christian faith is obviously you protect life and you try your best and bits like that. And that's okay. You know, that's what the Bible says. But in real life, Stephen, in real life, I mean, you've got to live in reality, in reality as well. And at times like this, it's whenever I can't put opinions on things that if somebody's struggling and they don't want to live, I think I set my beliefs and values to the side.
Can you see, just finally, can you see one of the dangers, and stress, I'm not talking about the Department of Health, this current administration, I'm not even talking about the Department of Health in this country, right?
Yeah.
But anywhere. But can you see at least the danger that it might not even be pressure from family, mm-hmm. that you could have a Department of Health or a government that can't make the health service work because they're stretched for resource, and therefore, you know, it might just be handy for people mm-hmm. in there who don't have a good quality of life, maybe they're in their 70s mm-hmm. or their 80s, to be subliminally pressured to consider mm-hmm. and therefore alleviate cost to the NHS. Can you see the danger in that?
No,
because we don't know who the next
see...
government is. We don't know who a leader, a future prime minister will be.
And I know that they haven't been, you know, they haven't been great over the years at having the executive up and running. But as you stated earlier, there's different stages of this process. It's not something that somebody can just sign up to. It seems as if it's a rigorous, you know, process and many stages and steps in it. So I don't think it's going to be that easy. And it really will be taken into consideration.
Thank you so much for talking to me today. 03030805555. We'll come back to calls in this. We'll come back to calls in the Children's Maternity Hospital. Next, traffic bumper to bumper, bus services suspended, rush hour, a daily nightmare for lots of you. We've lost count of the amount of times we've spoken about the gridlock in Belfast City Centre. Well, now is it about to get a lot better? Roads officials at Stormont have come up with a plan. Roadworks in places like the Sydenham Bypass, that's already been suspended in the run-up to Christmas. Now John O'Dowd's Department of Infrastructure is changing traffic light signals near the new Grand Central Station. It's cracking down on drivers flouting the rules around those yellow boxes at junctions. If you sit in one of those, you're going to be done. And it's putting more traffic information out on Twitter, now known as X. Roads expert Wesley Johnson with us today. Mr. Johnson, good morning.
Good morning.
So will this have a significant impact? Will this improve things dramatically?
You talked about two different things there. You talked about the roadworks moratorium over Christmas, over December, and you talked about the Grand Central Station mitigations. I would see that second one as more of a mitigation than a solution. You know, there's the most recent traffic chaos around Grand Central Station has been caused primarily by the closure of the Boyne Bridge. And until that reopens again, we're not going to see an enormous change. But what this is a sort of an attempt to mitigate that in the absence of having that big solution. I think probably the traffic lights and yellow boxes are probably the most significant things in the package. You know, we've seen that it's the problems of those new pedestrian crossings, the timings at those junctions that have been causing additional delays over and above what you would have had previously. And also, you know, the problem with yellow boxes. If the PSNI are able to come through and enforce yellow boxes better, that would be a good thing as well.
Really? So pulling resource out of the PSNI to police a yellow box, when that force is telling us they're stretched to the point where, you know, they can't provide a basic service sometimes.
Well, this is why I say if they're able to. I mean, the DFI press release said that the PSNI is one of the four organisations in this task group. So, you know, it looks like they are intending to do that, you know, but whether they're going to be sitting there 24 hours a day, unlikely. But I think a little bit of visible enforcement would probably go a long way. It won't just help car drivers, of course, it'll help the buses as well, because everyone gets stuck when people park in yellow boxes.
So these yellow boxes, if with the Boyne Bridge closed, Wesley, I'm wondering how fair it is, basically, that you've got the Boyne Bridge closed for the guts of another year at least, right? Let's see how long that runs on to in reality. Time will tell. You've got gridlock in our city centre. And now if someone makes a mistake in the gridlock and they're on a yellow bus, they're in this yellow box, we're coming down on them like a ton of bricks. Does that feel fair?
Well, I mean, it's an offence to stop in a yellow box, and the reason it is because it then blocks traffic going the other direction.
Well, it might be an offence, but how offensive is the gridlock to working people at the minute?
Yeah, this is one of the, you know, enforcing yellow boxes is one of the things designed to prevent that. I mean, but we have to be clear here, there is a bigger issue as well, which is, you know, not just the Boyne Bridge, but the fact that we've known since the 1990s that the city centre can't cope with the number of vehicles that are trying to drive into it. You know, and that's the fundamental problem. We're nowhere near having a solution to that problem yet. I mean, public transport is part of the answer, but we're a long way from that being viable for a lot of people.
How do the police police the yellow box? Like, they're hardly going to be standing there. So how do they police it?
I mean,
and can Canberra not do that?
Parking yellow box, it's a type of offence that has to be observed. So, I mean, it probably does imply that someone would be sitting observing it. I'm not sure that a camera, I mean, that would require additional powers. I'm not sure that can be done. It's what you
works
call
in
a
America, doesn't
offense.
It?
That, yeah, well, very different system, isn't it? You know, it's you know, I don't think you would expect to see a police officer standing beside every yellow box throughout every working day. That's not going to happen. But if you had someone there periodically and people could see that happening, you know, maybe it would make people think twice before they actually, you know, end up parking there.
For those people who are thinking the aim here is at the individual motorist rather than the policy decision to have all of these roadworks at the same time, to have the Boyne Bridge being closed at the same time that there were roadworks elsewhere, and the expansion of bus lanes, that this is diverting attention away from those who should be taking the responsibility for the gridlock. So let me get your understanding, Wesley. How effective, statistically, hard data, are bus lanes? Like, do they work?
There's a kind of a... It's a difficult question to answer whether yes or no, because what the problem we have at the minute is that there are too many people trying to use the same road space and they don't all fit. So how do you solve that? You either demolish buildings and build more roads, or you try and get more people into the road space that we have. Buses use a lot less road space per person, but to get people onto them, they need to be fast, and therefore you need to have bus lanes that are free. And then that frustrates people because they see this empty lane when they're sitting in heavy traffic. And yet, at the same time, people wouldn't switch to the bus if the bus was just going to be in the regular traffic. So there's a kind of a chicken and egg thing. We're not there yet, but, though, Stephen,
yeah.
Because we need...
Because
we need,
in the last 10 years, these bus lanes, which are everywhere around Belfast, they have not reduced the amount of people in cars, have they?
Well, it's hard to say now because the glider that's coming in from East Belfast, we had... a couple of weeks ago, we had news reports that they're so crowded now that there are people actually can't get onto the gliders coming down the Yetnard Road in some cases during the rush hour.
We got official data, and it doesn't seem to have had a significant impact on the number of people abandoning their car to get into the bus. And then, look, all these things I'm saying are pretty predictable, Wesley. And then there are quite a few people contact this program saying, how can I use public transport if it's so unreliable?
Yeah, I think we have to give a lot of leeway to motorists here. I mean, people are sensible. They're not using their cars because they're, you know, unable to understand or anything. They're using it for good, rational reasons. To get people to use public transport, it needs to be cheaper and it needs to be reliable and it needs to be convenient. I mean, at the minute, fares, honestly, are too high. They don't compare favourably with parking. Secondly, the park and rides, East Belfast, the one at Dundonald, you know, it's full by 8:30 in the morning. I mean, it's very, very popular, but that means that if you turn up at 9 o'clock, you're not guaranteed that you're going to get a space there. So, you know, that discourages people from doing it. So I think park and ride has been one of the most successful things we've done in this city in terms of public transport. But I think there's a lot of scope to improve it even more. And ideally, I don't see how this can happen in the current climate, but ideally bring down the fares as well so that it's cheaper to use it.
I just want to go back because it's in my mind. And thanks for the conversation today. Is it not nigh on farcical in the context of a chief constable saying that they can't provide, they're so stretched that they can't provide the basic service, that they desperately need more people, that we're going to have a police officer, and a police officer doesn't stand alone. They come in twos.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to have pairs of police officers at yellow boxes now.
I'd say it's probably one or two yellow boxes. It's going to be the yellow boxes around Grosvenor Road, at Durham Street Junction, and around Great Victoria Street. So it's probably not going to be all around the city. It'll be just that particular area
still,
around Grand Central Station.
I've watched the police around that area in terms of I know how stretched they are. Mm-hmm. And they're racing from a domestic abuse incident to an arrest to fights on the street to someone in trouble in a car accident. And we're not going to put a camera up. We haven't got to that stage of development in Northern Ireland where we can put a camera up in a yellow box. Now we have two police officers and you know, waiting to catch people sitting in that yellow box.
Yeah, I mean, it's a case of, I mean, no department has any money, basically, is the bottom line, isn't it, Stephen? You know, the police don't have any money, DFI don't appear to have any money for, you know, anything other than what the executive wants them to build. So, you know, we have this problem and, you know, roads are never going to pip schools and hospitals when it comes to budgets, which means that, you know, if when we're short of money, we're always going to end up with potholes, we're going to end up with road schemes getting put back, and we're going to end up with situations like this, you know, where we have underfunded public transport and inadequate enforcement on the roads. You know, and until, I think really fundamentally, until we work out a way to have more money to spend in Northern Ireland, that's kind of just the way it has to be, frustrating as it is.
Interesting. Wesley, thank you very much. Pat the taxi driver. Morning, Pat the taxi driver.
Morning, Stephen.
You're not called Pat anymore. You're Pat the taxi driver. What do you make of this then? They're going to be doing this. Look, yellow box junctions, it's an important part, isn't it? If we respect the law, we respect the rules, it keeps the traffic flowing. Do you think what O'Dowd, Minister O'Dowd's proposing is going to make the situation any better?
No, Stephen, I think it's going to make it worse. I don't know who's coming up. It's the civil service. It's not O'Dowd. These boys are sitting in offices and coming up. This is a great idea. I don't think they actually drive. Every single thing that they're coming up with, Stephen, is to bait the motorist out of the car. Plain and simple. Even Wesley's saying there about getting more people on the bus, getting more people on the bus. See, if everybody wanted on the bus, Stephen, they'd be on it. They wouldn't be driving.
What do you mean?
Right, he's saying you have to quicken the buses up, yeah? You have to get more people on buses, get more people out of cars. Every single thing, they're actually trying to make TransLink make money. They haven't made money in 30 years, Stephen, and they're trying to make it. Most of the places, the other countries around the world, have done away with these bendy buses. Liverpool did away with the bus lanes. They're not working. Belfast bus lanes aren't working, Stephen. Every single day, every night.
Well, they might work more if you get into the bus.
Well, I can't get in a bus, Stephen.
And lo and behold, taxi driver who wants a couple of quid is against buses. Ooh,
no,
there's
not against
a surprise.
Buses, Stephen. I'm against people being penalised for, as you say, a mistake. If you're driving along a road, Stephen, and all of a sudden the traffic stops and you're stuck in a yellow box, you can't go anywhere because the traffic in Belfast has just stopped abruptly and you're stuck there.
You shouldn't be sitting in the box, should you?
Is that fair?
The whole point of the box is you shouldn't be sitting on the box.
You're missing the point, Stephen. If you're moving in traffic and the traffic stops, bump, you're stuck. You can't go anywhere.
Well, don't move into the box.
What are you meant to do? Stay 50 feet behind everybody?
Yes,
no, Stephen.
Do you understand the premise of a box? You don't sit on the box.
Does that mean whenever the police go into the box that they're going to get penalised as well, Stephen? Because they do it as well. It's like our taxi ranks around the town. People are parking in them. And that same department are telling us they can't do anything about it, but they can stop people getting in a yellow box. Come on, Stephen.
Glenn Roberts, Chief Executive of Retail NI. Good morning to you, Glenn.
Good morning, Stephen.
I am not spending all day talking about this yellow box. I'm not doing it. But your man here doesn't understand. If you can't get stuck in the box, if you don't go into it. Anyway, Glenn, are you confident now? Are you confident that as much is being done as possible in the run-up to Christmas here?
I'm hoping. I mean, obviously, as the statement that they released last week said, there's a new oversight group, which I hope will coordinate and address congestion. I think we've got the moratorium in place, so hopefully all major roadworks and other major works with the hub and the bypass we put in hold. I have another question. Does that include utility work? Because quite often utility work can delay traffic as well. There's issues about taxis in the bus lane. So there are a number of questions that I have, but I am
What's this oversight group?
What's so that? Apparently it's a new group that's set up with Department of Infrastructure, the Council, PSNI and Transink. I met with the Chief Executive, Chris Conway, a few weeks ago. He indicated this was going to be set up. That is a step forward. Maybe it is better late than never, but it's there. So I hope that will make a difference.
Well, tell me this. Is the oversight group leading by example? When they go to their wee meetings, have they all been on the bus or the train? Hope they're not driving in their car.
Well, you're going to have them, that, Stephen. I don't know. We're not on this group. But listen,
the oversight group wouldn't be getting into a car. Surely they'd all be on the bus, standing there. And if the bus is delayed or it comes up on the wee screen, you'll have to walk or whatever, because we're not now picking up from here. Bus cancelled, whatever. Standing in the rain, getting soaked. I hope everyone in that oversight group is not sitting in their wee nice car with a heater on. Some people might argue.
You're going to have to ask them, Stephen. I couldn't answer that. But
we will.
One of the other points is that, look, we now need to focus on trying to create the best experience possible for shoppers and visitors, not just to Belfast City Centre, but to all our high streets in Northern Ireland. You know, this is an important time of the year for our members. It's the harvest time where they make significant amount of income, sustains the business throughout the year. So we've got to really focus on making this the best Christmas yet for shoppers and the visitors into our high streets. But I would say this, we need going forward better communication, better coordination in this. It has been an issue. It's sustained many issues in your program for quite a few weeks now. So I think we need to learn the lessons and make sure that this type of lack of coordination doesn't happen again.
Tell you what, I'll say this. I'm never in the town. Never. It's too far to walk from me, from the BBC, that whatever it is, a few hundred yards into the town. I had to be into the town for work the other night. And although it was cold, it is beautiful. Belfast City Centre, in my view, would stand up to lots of these other places that I have to get on a plane and travel to. It was stunningly beautiful the other night.
Well, absolutely, Stephen. And quite often we can get dragged into this narrative that it's a city centre decline. It's not. I mean, if you look at the new investment that we've had from the Ivy to the new Charles Sturt store to the expanded Apple store, you know, there's a lot that is going on. There's a lot to offer to shoppers. And of course, 50% of all retail in Belfast City Centre is independent. So we have a lot to offer. And I know our colleagues in hospitality are pulling out all the stops to make sure that this is the best Christmas yet. So I would encourage people in terms of public transport, I would encourage them to make it their first option rather than their last option. I think that's an important message we need to get across.
The Christmas market's interesting because it's beautiful too. But I just wonder how fair it is on those people that pay rates all year round for that to land in front of them as competition once a year.
Well, we should never forget we've got a fantastic St. George's Market. Great traders in there, great local produce. We shouldn't forget about that market as well.
Okay. Glenn, thanks very much indeed. Lots of you calling this morning, so we'll get you on air in a few minutes' time. 030 30 80 55 55. It's the biggest show in the country. It's the Nolan Show from the BBC. Back in just a second after the news at 10. We're talking about the traffic this morning. Pat, are you still there? Pat the taxi
driver. Yes, I'm still here. I'm sitting in a yellow box here, Stephen, yeah.
Department for Infrastructure spokesperson said the department is taking forward the legislative arrangements to allow the commencement of an experimental traffic control system that will permit Class A and Class C taxis to use certain bus lanes in the vicinity of Belfast Central Station to alleviate some of the congestion being caused by the ongoing works in the area. Further details will be announced as soon as possible. Class A and Class C are going to be allowed to use the bus lanes.
It looks as if everybody's going to be allowed to use bus lanes. Stephen, they come up with these great wee ideas.
No, I'm not.
But they do. And they said this, 2 months ago, and they still haven't allowed the taxis in. I think they're just dangling a carrot to get everybody to keep quiet, and we're going to do this for you. And then they pull the rug from under them, and they bring out this thing about yellow boxes and such.
Yeah, but I know you lot in the taxi family get wound up on me sometimes, but I want to know why you lot, even if you're driving on your own or with one passenger, are getting special treatment ahead of a family, maybe bringing two kids and mom and dad to work in a car. Why is this not deemed in terms of access to a bus lane as to, for example, how many people are in the car? That's what they do with some restricted lanes in America. It's all about, have you got a car packed with people? Why should a taxi driver get special access to a bus lane? Why?
Well, Stephen, whenever I said you there...
And then I'm sitting in the full lane watching you lot drive past, or if I go into the bus lane, I'm done for 45 quid, or 90 if I don't pay it in time.
But Stephen, you sitting there gives you a chance to eat your KFC. Do you know what I mean? Other chicken is available, of course. But whenever I say to you about Joe Anderson in Liverpool doing away with the bus lanes because they weren't working, you shouted at me. So make it, do you know what I mean? Make your mind up, Stephen. You're either for bus lanes or you're against them. Open up.
I'm not for or against when I'm on the BBC, but I am asking the question, why is the department giving special treatment to taxis and not special treatment to somebody, you know, they're maybe doing a car share and there's maybe 3, 4, 5 people in the car compared to you lot waving at us going down the bus lane?
But if there's a bus going down with just a driver in it, should he not be on the bus then? We're a public service, the same as the buses. We're PSV, public service vehicle. Do you know what I mean? It's on the tin what we do, public service. We're not a normal car. You know, some of the big vehicles are costing tens of thousands of pounds, and these people are trying to put us off the road.
What do you think we're paying for a private car? And by the way, you see Liverpool you talk about, 10 years after scrapping the bus lanes, the BBC was reporting last year they're trying to bring them back. Are they going to bring them back?
No, they're not, Stephen. They're trying.
Yes,
they're
are.
Stephen, the dandy buses around the world have been done away with and we're bringing them in. Our country, these people sit in these offices getting hundreds of thousands of pounds coming up with these ideas. There's boys there running things, the legislation to do with the taxi industry. They've never driven a taxi in their life, Stephen. They haven't a clue. See the ordinary working class person here in this country at the minute? We're getting walked on, Stephen.
Alex is next. Morning, Alex.
Millionaires are looked
on.
We're not.
Morning.
I just make a suggestion. You know, a lot of technology, a lot of investment in cameras to catch people in 30-mile-an-hour zones doing 34-mile-an-hour when the serious accidents occur on the major fast roads. There's bound to be technology there. You can park a camera near a yellow box and it can read the traffic signs and it can see traffic. It can register traffic within the box.
Not available in Northern Ireland, apparently, according to Wesley. We'll check with the department. We're going to have two cops sitting there.
Listen, my wife's car is a 2016 Honda and it can read the traffic signs.
And by the way, when you say about the high-speed zones, a pedestrian who's hit at 30 mile an hour has a significant chance of getting killed, and that... chance of getting killed. And that potential to die significantly increases at 35 mile an hour. That's the difference the 5 miles an hour can cost someone. Alan, morning to you. Thank you, Alex. Morning, Alan. Good morning. Alan's not there. Richard. Good morning, Richard.
Let the traffic wardens look out the yellow boxes so that they so people know that it's stuck in the yellow box and
I can just about hear that from your signal. We'll try Billy next. Morning, Billy.
Morning, Stephen. Stephen.
Good morning.
Surely you could kill two birds with one stone here and settle different arguments by suspending all bus lanes from May for approximately 6 weeks. This is right over the Christmas period and right through. And then look at the data of, are they helping?
Well, do you think they are?
Well, I don't think they are, no, because I'm going to tell you why. I get on these new buses at Transnet, excuse me. I got on the bus on Saturday and I had two bags. And I tried to walk. I couldn't get a seat near the front of the bus. So obviously you have to head towards the back. And I tell you, I couldn't move. And it wasn't because of people. There's no, they're that narrow. The seats, there's not much room.
Oh, are they?
Actually, the new buses are a nightmare. And I don't think most
the seats?
People.
The seats? Would a man with a large behind like mine be able to fit into the seat?
Oh, you'd be stuck, Stephen. maybe have to get the fire brigade for you, you know. But
would your thighs be rubbing up against mine?
No, I would just avoid you, to be honest with you.
If we were sitting beside each other, would I have to put my arm around you?
No, you would take up the two seats.
Oh, my goodness.
I tell you, them new buses are... People will tell you, yes, there's room at the front for disabled people. But try and walk up the corridor, or up the corridor that there is in the bus, carrying something. And I'm telling you, you'll find it very, very hard.
And do you use public transport a lot?
Well, I do now, yes. But it's...
Is it reliable?
No. And I'll tell you why. I'll give you a quick one. Three Saturdays ago, I was in town, and there was protesters at the City Hall. And right. I got my bus. Now, it used to be in Queen Street at night. It's now outside Marks and Spencer's. So I went to the bus stop. No buses. And these people are shouting and roaring about Palestine, about this, about yes. that, and the other thing. So there was an inspector there. And I says,
yes.
Where do I get my bus? Well, it's suspended. You either have to go to the bottom of Chichester Street or you have to go around the Littles and High Street.
See, by the time I'd walked to the bus stop and then suspended and exhausted.
When I got there, it was 12:05. And I said to myself, I am going to see how long it takes a bus to come. And all the number one buses, which are actually behind the number
two. What time did it come at, Billy? Cut to the chase, punchline.
I was there 10:50.
Oh, my goodness. 50 minutes.
And I made a complaint to TransLink on the Monday after that, and I'm still waiting on an answer. And I was told the wrong information was on. There, what
Billy, thank you.
Website.
Let me see if I can squeeze Jeff in this morning. Thank you, Billy. Morning, Jeff.
Morning.
Go ahead, Jeff.
Yes. Hi there. Yeah, I agree. The bus service issues aside, the yellow boxes, people are not supposed to enter the intersection if you can't get through. The entire point of the yellow boxes. And I also agree that the police should have some cameras up to catch anybody that's sitting in the yellow box for more than 10 seconds.
Really?
Yeah. That's
if we make a wee mistake, make a wee slip up. I've got caught in those yellow boxes a number of times. Not caught by the police, but just caught in that. I feel like a fool. I've thought I'd be able to keep going, and I haven't been able to. Anyway, thank you very much. Oh, he's away. Thank you very much indeed. Morning to you. What time is it? It's coming up to 14 minutes past 10.
I'm too sexy for my love. Too sexy for my love. Love's going to leave.
Now, is naming the world's sexiest man sexist? The People magazine has named actor John Krasinski, I've never heard of him, what's he do, as the sexiest man alive for 2024. But the People magazine did away with listing the sexiest women years ago. So is it all right to name sexiest men but not sexiest women? Is that not sexist? Commentator Emma Wolfe, businessman Chris Souter with me this morning. Good morning, Emma.
Good morning.
Good morning, Chris.
Good morning.
Well, Emma, what do you think?
Well, I'm sorry, but it is a bit sexist. If we're going to say that we can't call women the sexiest women on the planet, what are we doing objectifying men in this way? You know, women say that they want a level playing field, that they want equality, they want to be treated exactly the way that men are. Well, if we have, and I don't have a problem with sexiest woman, sexiest man, but if women have a problem with sexiest woman, then what are they doing calling John Krasinski, who, by the way, is definitely not the sexiest man on the planet, the sexiest... He's an actor. He's a Hollywood actor. This is double standard.
Chris?
Yeah, do you know what, Stephen? I think there is an element of double standards in it, but I'm a father of two daughters. I know that ladies and girls, sorry, females, are objectified slightly differently from the male perspective. So as much as I make men sexy every day of the week, Stephen, as you know in my job, I do find just a little bit of an issue with the sexiest woman thing. I think it is all a bit of fun, Stephen, to be fair, and I think maybe we just don't get too lost in it. it is all a bit of fun. But did we ever find out what the rationale was?
But you say it is a bit of fun, but is there not an important principle behind this here? That if society is, and that's an if, but if society is saying, look, it's not politically correct anymore, it's not acceptable to objectify a woman by having a sexiest woman competition, then why is it all right for men?
Yeah, I just think the girls, the females, said about just get attacked an awful lot. It's an awful situation nowadays with social media and stuff, Stephen, the way you can go on, people from all over the world can now comment on
men don't get that too?
They do, but I just think men can handle it better, Stephen, and the men definitely don't get it. But they
is that not sexist?
But yeah, they definitely don't. But they don't get it as bad as what the girls do. That's the thing. And
men can handle it better, Emma.
I think this.
There is a more serious point here, which is, Chris is absolutely right. For decades, for centuries, women have been objectified as, you know, basically just sort of, you know, the body, the face, the looks, and have been judged and rated on their attractiveness and on how they look, on their appearance. But actually those pressures and that appearance pressure is now increasing on young men and men of all ages. If you look at the covers of those magazines, if you look online, you'll see that men are, you know, absolutely the kind of male models that make other men feel really inadequate. Things like eating disorders, body dysmorphia, mental illness, depression, anxiety, all of those are really increasing amongst men, especially amongst young men, and as well as you know, male suicide and things like that. So we do, although it's a laugh and it's a joke to talk about the sexiest man, sexiest woman, we do have to be aware of those pressures, especially on young men. And they are being, just as women used to be, men are being bombarded now with the body beautiful, you know, this idea of perfection, this idea of never measuring up, this idea of airbrushed images everywhere. And it does have an impact on their mental health.
Stephen, can I come in on that there?
Cause
this is actually a great part of the conversation. This guy, John Krasinski, is your non-stereotypical sexiest man, in my opinion. In fact, if anything, he's a role model. He loves his wife. He's got two daughters. He's not, in my opinion, the most perfectly beautiful specimen of man that's ever been born. But he has been judged world's sexiest man based on a whole raft of things, including his personality, including how he presents himself in front of the camera, including how he is as a father and as a husband. And then he just happens to be handsome now at the same time, too. So you can flip this argument on the other side and hope now that these publications that put forward their sexiest list do take in other things to account, i.e. what the person is actually like. And I think this is where my wee issue just is over the years with the sexiest female thing, where they've kind of really just been, the girls have just been judged on their looks alone. I think that the world's sexiest man has actually came into the 21st century with this new guy, John, because, by the way, I don't know who he is either, Stephen. I had to look him up.
Never heard of him.
In the office. Yeah, he's just like he is like your regular guy next door. And I think having him as the world's sexiest man can only do good. Now, whether that will,
but would it be
Emma
okay? But would it even if you don't get him?
He's a millionaire Hollywood actor, and he's married to Emily Blunt. And, you know, he's not a regular guy, and we know nothing about his home life or his family life. I mean, frankly, no one does.
But even if we don't get into the individual, Emma, would it be acceptable these days to have a sexiest woman competition? Or is that off limits now?
Well, look. But there are it may not be called the sexiest woman, but we know that attractiveness is a massive premium. We know that the sexiest women, I mean, I've just been reviewing the papers and the second page of The Sun, i.e. page 3, has still got women. They're not now topless. But, I mean, we have sexy women, we have attractive, gorgeous-looking women everywhere, on every single magazine.
But do we have competitions that actually rate them and assess them and champion them? Do we have a sexiest woman competition somewhere?
In some countries, we still have Miss World.
Do we in the UK?
Well, I'm not sure. Do we still have Miss World in the UK? I mean, there was a big fuss recently with Miss France because she had short hair. And that was seen as incredibly shocking, that a sexy woman could have a lovely pixie crop hair. But look, I just think it's about double standards.
Okay?
If we're going to call men sexiest man alive, then we should be able to call women sexiest woman alive.
It was a couple of months ago I saw this article. It was around when the swimmers were competing. Mm. And one of our tabloid newspapers, in fact, I think it was one of the biggest selling tabloid newspapers, circled one of the swimmers' crotches when they were in their swimming pants. And they were talking about the size of his you-know-what. And I thought to myself, right, everybody was having a laugh at that. And I wondered to myself, hold on a minute, can you imagine if that was done to a woman?
But it is, would everybody Stephen, have it is done,
well, there's nobody circling a woman's crotch and there's nobody circling a woman's breasts and going, oh, look, it's ha-ha. Not, it's of the past, that. But it still happens to
not,
men, doesn't it?
Stephen, let me just respond to that, because I'm a woman. Of course it's not done overtly. It's not done with an actual
this
circle.
This is done overtly is my point.
Yes, okay, fine. But every single time there's like a sunny day, we have pictures of attractive, you know, the most gorgeous girls running along the beach. You have that on the front of the Times, the Telegraph, all of those kind of papers. Of course, in every photograph, you have the woman with the perfect bust, the woman with the perfect cleavage, all of that. It's just not done overtly. Sexism, and in terms of what we rate and what the media like to show, is all
I need
over
to find
the place.
This newspaper coverage now in the newspaper headline, but it was literally a headline over the size of this guy's genitals, right? So, like, how is that? Is that not two-tier, a different standard being applied to men now, Chris, where it's basically, it's all right to objectify, to have a laugh at men's bodies. It's not quite as all right about women now.
Yeah, it is, Stephen, and I think we need to be prudent that just times change, Stephen, and people change, and society changes. And as I say, I'm a father of two daughters, and as much as they're very pretty wee girls and stuff like that, I don't want to grow up thinking that they're going to be sexualized the way women have maybe been in the past, Stephen. And I think just as long as we, as a society, keep that in the forefront of our minds, that I stand by my comment there, that I think men can handle it better. I think it's just, it's the way it's being.
How is that not sexist?
I suppose it is in a way. Maybe it's just the way we're wired, Stephen. Maybe men are wired different than females, and we can handle the criticism better. Now, obviously, as Emma pointed out, there are probably many men and many males around the world that maybe can't handle it, and that is an issue we have to address. But just historically, men have just been able to deal with it better, and I think we need to protect the girls. We need to protect the women on that. Oh, what do you think, Emma?
No, this is such a wrong-headed argument, Chris, with respect. It's not that men have been able to handle it better. It's that men have not been judged on their appearance. Let me tell you, for years, men can be a bit paunchy. They can still be hot. They can be going grey. They can still be considered sexy and powerful and attractive. It's that women have this standard of perfection that we've been measured up to, that we've been measured against, and that men have not had that. It's fine if you're a man to be a bit older, to be a bit grey, to be a little bit tubby. Women don't mind that. But for women, the standard is much, much higher. The bar is much higher. That is
Agreed, Emma. So do you think the actual, do you think there's a change in the guard almost, that men are now becoming sexualized nearly more than women?
Because of social media and because of airbrushing and because of this idea that these filters, this filter fabulous kind of lifestyle, this is what men now think they need to, younger men, they think they need to look like that. They don't realise that's not real life. So in a way, it's levelling the playing field. But I think it's really sad that men or women or girls or boys should have to be spending their time, their nonsense, you know, sort of wasting time on this kind of nonsense, because none of it is real. And we know, we all know, the most attractive thing is not the perfect people. It's the ones who are like a bit funny, but also kind of quirky and a bit, you know, you're just attracted to people because of the chemistry, the vibe between you. It's not about how they look, really.
Really?
Emma, looks aren't so important, really? Could you argue it's a good thing then that men are getting more more coverage nowadays? And does it mean that men start to look after themselves better, start to work out more, look after their health better, which can actually then only add to a better male society? Is that not an argument?
No, I would say I'd like everybody to be of a healthy weight and an active lifestyle, eating well. But I don't want anyone to be aspiring to look like, you know, a very, very dangerously ripped torso model in you know, a men's magazine. That kind of stuff is not healthy, and it doesn't, that stuff doesn't matter. I don't, just because women have been held to this pressure, I don't think we want men plucking their eyebrows and cover, you know, spending hours on fake tan and all that. There's more male makeup, all of that stuff. It's not necessary. And Stephen, in response to what you said, I don't think looks matter that much. You can go out for a date with someone who's very, very attractive, and you can be utterly bored. Yeah, you can
as you get older,
you realize you've fallen in love with someone who is not at all how you would expect them to be,
Hold on a minute, as you get older, maybe looks, you know, you get into your 40s, your 50s, whatever, maybe looks aren't as important as someone who you've known for 20 or 30 years. I get that. But you're not going to start to tell me that 19, 20, 21, in your 20s, that looks are not incredibly powerful, Emma. Are you?
Well, it depends what you want. What you're describing is basically a one-night stand, a hookup. Yeah, you kind of meet someone and there's lots
of... Well, I'm talking about attraction. Looks are part of attraction.
Yeah, but to me, you go out on a date with someone who's very, very... And I'm straight, so I go out on a date with a very, very handsome man. And you'd be, if they're not interesting and funny and intelligent... Honestly,
yeah, but
I'm
if
not
you didn't like
this.
The physicality of them, you wouldn't get to the point of finding out if they're intelligent, would you?
No, but I'm just saying, if someone isn't intelligent and funny and warm and they listen and they're empathetic and they're interesting, then there is no chemistry between people. But everybody's different.
You see, it's interesting because, Chris, your game is about making people look as well as they can, and the suits you sell, the shirts they sell, etc., etc. So you obviously think looks are important.
Yeah, and definitely, Stephen, I think we don't lose sight of the fact that this guy, John, isn't John Krasinski, how do you say his surname, Stephen?
Krasinski,
John Krasinski. He's 45. He's a middle-aged man. I think we need to champion this. You know, and again, I know the question at the start of the show was about whether it's sexist that we don't have a sexist woman on, but I think, you know, going down a different rabbit hole, we should actually be championing John, that he's 45 years old, he's in good shape, he's married a superstar in Emily Blunt, he's like, and again, I mean personally, and like, I not that I'm judging anybody's looks, he's not, in my opinion, the most handsome person, but he is handsome, but he's no Richard Gere, right? But he has been able to get the accolade of world's sexiest man based on more than just his looks, and I think that has to be championed. You
give
know,
me
so,
a break. Brad Pitt, who is always judged as the world's sexiest man, he's like 60. Yeah. That's the thing. Age doesn't matter for men, right? The fact that we can say Brad Pitt is still considered very, very sexy and he's 60. Yeah. Can you imagine a 60-year-old woman? You see, do you see the inequity? Do you see the inequality? Can you imagine a 60-year-old woman being voted sexiest man of all time?
Yeah, I know, and you know, to be fair, Emma, you definitely have a point with that, 100%. But, you know, I think if we step aside from that and just, like, champion, we're championing the men. Emma, you don't know, but I do. I have a men's business, I dress men. And it is, I just think it's so lovely to see him up there as the world's sexiest man at 45. It's incredible. And Stephen, yeah, you know, there's a lot of my business is built around making men feel better about themselves, using clever and tailoring tricks to make them feel better. And as much as I do think, I sort of agree with Emma there, that you're not going to see a 60-year-old woman at the top of the world's sexiest list, I think we champion the men right now and big up to John. Fair play to him for winning it. But on the other side, I do just think we need to protect the girls on the sexist woman side.
Chris and Emma, thank you very much for talking to us today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Emma.
Well, that's about it from us for today. Thanks very much indeed for your company. We'll be back with more Nolan at 9 tomorrow morning. In between, look after yourself today, and thanks for listening. Bye-bye, everyone.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @StephenNolan.